Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrent Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lowther, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrent Studies. The NY Deterrent Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I am Adam Wilder, your host. And today we have a great guest who's going to talk about a topic we've never talked about before. Now, I'll pause for just a second. I want you to guess what we're going to talk about. Okay, you've got your guess. Now I'm going to tell you what it is. So we're talking to Ken Myers, who is the Senior Vice President at Fluor. But in a past life, he was the director of DITRA, the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, and we're going to talk about DITRA. We're going to talk about its mission. We're going to talk about the day in which STRATCOM's Unified Command Plan was changed and the CWMD mission, the Countering Weapons of Mass Destruction mission, went from STRATCOM over to SOCOM, and we'll talk about a few other topics. But before we get into it, Ken, welcome to NucleCast.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
So we want to talk about DITRA. Now, we've never on NucleCast, in 150-plus episodes, we've never actually talked about DITRA or its mission. So this is kind of a perfect time, and you're the perfect guy to talk about what DITRA is and what it does and sort of what its history, where did it come from? So with that, I'll turn it over to you and tell us about DITRA.
Well, the Defense Threat Reduction Agency is one of many different defense agencies and combat support agencies that supports the warfighter and the Department of Defense. The interesting thing about DITRA, especially during my time there, during my tenure, was DITRA acted as a defense agency, it acted as a combat support agency, and it was also an element of the U.S. Strategic Command. In other words, I was dual-hatted. I reported to the Undersecretary for AT&L, Acquisition Technology and Logistics at that time, as well as reporting to the U.S. Commander of STRATCOM. But also, I also had responsibilities to the combat support agency, and I reported to the chairman and the vice chairman and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So a lot of different bosses, a lot of different missions. You know, historically, DITRA has its roots back in the Manhattan Project. I mean, a lot of the brain power, a lot of the experience, a lot of the expertise came from DITRA's forerunners in support of the Manhattan Project. And over the years, the agency has obviously grown. It has expanded its responsibilities and its missions, but direct support to the warfighter continues to this day. And it's a critically important element of what they do. You know, I think through the three commanders that I reported to at STRATCOM, Kevin Chilton, Bob Kaler, Cecil Haney, all of them were incredibly thankful and reliant upon DITRA. Not only on, you know, operational support, but the research and development support as well. And I'm happy to burrow down into each of those. But I will tell you, just kind of overall, one of the most unique places in the world at the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. I can't tell you how many world leaders, whether they be ministers of defense, ministers of foreign affairs, who would come visit Fort Belvoir, and all of them walked away saying the same thing. We really wish we could have a DITRA, you know, whether it be after, you know, the issues in Japan with the tsunami, all of the visitors we had come. It is really one of the most unique locations and places and workforces in the world. It truly is a national treasure.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't DITRA early on, it was Defense Nuclear Agency, correct?
It was Defense Nuclear Agency. It was Defense Special Weapons Agency. And, you know, I think those two names are important for people to remember, because, like I said, a lot of people think that DITRA's role is entirely non-proliferation. It is entirely counter-proliferation. And that's a big part of what they do. But direct support to the U.S. nuclear weapons mission and the STRATCOM mission is a huge element of what they do. And also keep in mind, in its role as a defense agency, they do create, they do contribute to offensive capabilities that are used by our warfighters to deal with specialized, unique threats around the world.
So for me, as I think about DITRA, and maybe this is sort of a, you know, as the mission has changed, you know, so when the Cold War ends, the non-proliferation, counter-proliferation becomes more important. DITRA sort of shifts its mission. And for me, I mostly know DITRA for using the software to calculate weapons effects, because they sure. build that, or, you know, they sponsor the creation sure. of that software. So that's my big interaction with DITRA.
Sure.
But when you talk about the other things that DITRA does, and you talk about, you know, R&D, you know, we know they support non-pro and counter-pro efforts. Tell us about these different mission areas.
Well, I'm more than happy to do that. I think the most important thing for everyone to understand is that it is constantly evolving. It is evolving to meet the threat. So as the threat evolves, comes from new locations, new levels of intensity, new levels of sophistication, so does the DITRA response. But I'll give you a couple of examples. One, many people don't know that, you know, DITRA was on the front lines in terms of battling the Ebola outbreak in Africa, on the ground supporting the U.S. military, on the ground supporting local ministries of health and human services throughout the African continent, and we played a pivotal role in developing the different type of treatment methods that were brought to bear on that problem. You know, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people don't realize, you know, the role that DITRA played in responding to the disaster at Fukushima. I mean, you had literally tens of thousands of U.S. Soldiers, airmen, Marine, naval officers, and their families in Japan. And you had a U.S. Forces Japan commander trying to figure out, how do I communicate this with my people? How do I help our Japanese allies respond to this? Well, they didn't have that capability. You know, we had that at DITRA, as did our friends in the Department of Energy, NNSA, and elsewhere. I'm not saying we were the only ones on the ground, but we were there helping them. You know, similarly, a lot of people don't realize when we were eliminating the chemical weapons in Syria, I mean, that was primarily a DITRA mission in direct support and supported by elements of our friends up at the Aberdeen Proving Grounds. What they call now DEVCOM. We used to call it Edgewood Chemical Biological Center. But, I mean, that was a strong partnership. But DITRA was first and foremost. They were involved in that on a daily basis. You know, there's also been a number of different classified events and engagements that DITRA has participated in and contributed to. And it's really an incredibly diverse organization. I mean, it truly is one of those places, you know, it's a great melting pot. I mean, you have tier one special forces operators, you know, sitting down, working hand in hand with, you know, microbiologists, nuclear physicists, planners. You know, it really is one of those unique places where truly incredible and diverse solutions can be discovered and brought to bear on some of the most pressing threats to our country.
So as the mission has changed over the years, and we sort of know where we are today, do you see a need for DITRA's mission to change again as we sort of return to an era of where nuclear weapons are becoming a more central factor in strategic stability, where the North Korean arsenal, the Chinese arsenal, a potential Iranian arsenal are all, you know, sort of growing in importance? Do you see a time or a need to shift DITRA back to a more nuclear-focused mission, or do you still think the focus is about where it needs to be? What's your take on the mission, where it goes?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. To start off with, I don't think it ever changed or moved away from that. I don't think it's the part of the DITRA mission that most people talk about. I don't think it's part of the DITRA mission that most people focus on. But the incredible talent that the organization has, you know, in what we used to call J10, but now they call the nuclear enterprise, is second to none. I mean, absolute world-class expertise, and who get up and go to work every single day supporting the nuclear mission, supporting U.S. STRATCOM in that element. Similarly, you know, and equally important and talented are the folks that are down in our research and development directorate in nuclear technologies, you know, working on the modeling, working on assessing nuclear weapons effects, as you mentioned early on, you know, looking at different test concepts and capabilities, nuclear detonation detection. So I don't think that mission ever stopped. So it, obviously, you can dial it up, you can dial it down. You know, given the prospects or continued prospects for near peer competition, you know, no question that it has to remain a significant priority. But that's the great thing about having an organization like DITRA, and that is the DITRA director really has the ability to respond to the demand signals and the requests that they're getting from the combatant commands. I mean, that's who the customer is for DITRA. It is those combatant commanders. So when, you know, General Cotton picks up the phone and calls the DITRA director and says, I need X, Y, and Z, that goes to the top of the list. And if that's, you know, one has to move resources, move people, whatever the case might be, your job is to meet those demand signals. And, you know, thankfully, I think DITRA has done it for, you know, 50 plus years. And I hope and pray that it continues to do every 50, another 50 more, because that's truly the unique status that DITRA has and brings to the table to support the warfighter.
Now, you mentioned General Cotton, the current STRATCOM commander. So I wanted to switch gears and talk about, you know, STRATCOM also has sort of undergone a great deal of change over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years as missions have been broken out, you know, the space mission, the missile defense, CW countering weapons of mass destruction have all sort of moved elsewhere as STRATCOM focuses more on strategic nuclear deterrence. And so you were there when the CWMD mission shifted from STRATCOM to SOCOM. Talk about that and, you know, sort of sitting out of government now, what you thought about it and, you know, whether you think, is that the right place for it? You know, because DITRA is heavily involved in this mission.
Right.
And provides the technical support.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. You know, that was a difficult time. I mean, I think the Department of Defense was really looking for options on how to refocus all of us, civilian, military, what have you, on the nuclear deterrent mission. And the concern was at the time that STRATCOM had too many balls in the air. They had too many responsibilities, and we had to be taken away, dispersed elsewhere, so that STRATCOM could get back to their number one priority. And obviously, one of those is countering weapons of mass destruction. I will tell you, I had a fantastic relationship with each of my bosses out there. You know, I reported to General Chilton. I reported to General Kaler and to Admiral Haney. And, you know, I think there was a lot of benefit. I really do. Not just on the nuclear support side, but also on the counter WMD side. I never felt as though I was, you know, I was torn between, you know, reporting to the undersecretary, reporting to Commander STRATCOM. In fact, I felt my responsibility was to bring them together, was to help them find common ground. And I think thankfully in I would say just about every case that I can remember that occurred. And I think DITRA and the DITRA director played a role in that. But obviously, changes were made and it moved down to SOCOM. And, You know, I was there for the beginning, and then I departed before the process, before the changeover was concluded. And I was a strong advocate of the DITRA director taking on that same leadership element at SOCOM as it did at STRATCOM, because I really felt and I really was able to see the ground effects of that. To me, the big difference is we get demand signals, or we, sorry for the pronoun mix up. DITRA gets a lot of demand signals from all the combatant commanders. Okay. And if you're if under the unified command plan, it's your responsibility, as in SOCOM, to deal with the counter WMD mission, you want to make sure that you have the full attention of the combat support agency and the defense agency dealing with weapons of mass destruction, rather than being just one of another 13 different customers. And I tried to make the case that, during my time there, that to General Votel and to others that, hey, this is not a burden bringing DITRA in, dual hatting the director. In fact, you'll get a great deal of benefit from it. And ultimately, they decided to go in a different direction, which is obviously their purview. I'm not sure. You know, I've obviously it's been a few years since I was in the role, but I'm not sure that the relationship between DITRA and SOCOM is as strong as it is between DITRA and STRATCOM. I just don't know. But I would have to tell you, the relationship at STRATCOM was incredibly strong, good, and close.
Now it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break, so we'll do that. But when we come back, I want you to give our listeners a bit of a kind of an introduction to the difference between, we're familiar with the services, familiar with the joint staff, these sort of main defense components that receive funding. But then there's these defense support agencies. And so give us a little brief on what they are and how they're funded and who they report to. You're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLAW Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back. And of course, we're talking to Ken Myers. And I asked for you to give us this introduction to defense support agencies before the break. So I will turn it over to you for that.
Sure. No, it's a great question. I mean, I will tell you, during my tenure at DITRA and in the Pentagon, many of the defense agencies and combat support agencies reported up to the Undersecretary for Acquisition Technology and Logistics. At one point, I remember Undersecretary Kendall saying that, he had, 15 to 18 defense agencies and combat support agencies. And it was really something. You'd go to a Frank Kendall staff meeting, and on one side of me, I'd have the DARPA director. On the other side of me, I'd have the DLA director. And it was a really helpful venue, and it really brought us all together. I hope that continues today. I know some of them have been kind of spread out under different leadership structures and the like. But I really hope that continues, because a lot of goodness just comes from spending an hour together each week. But going back to your question, defense agencies, combat support agencies, their customer set is the combatant commands. Their customer set is the services. So every single year, each of those customers would submit their wish list. Maybe it's just an assessment, some kind of combat support, planning support, a number of different areas and the like. So, you'd walk in the door every single day, and you had an expectation of what your responsibility, what you were going to do that day, but your customers really set that agenda. Now, we tried to educate, we tried to guide, we tried to kind of share with them what we thought was the best path forward. But at the end of the day, You know, if you get a telephone call from the commander of STRATCOM, you get a telephone call from the commander of SOCOM, and they say, I need A, B, and C, you know, your next step is to pull the staff in and start figuring out how can you deliver A, B, and C for them. Obviously, this is even more important or even more critical, in combat situations when either specific expertise, specific experience, specific tools can be brought to bear. I mean, you know, I remember one of the there were two very, very large needs during my tenure. One was being able to hold a threat hardened, deeply buried targets. Right? I think that still probably is an issue today. So that's item one. Item two was, you know, subsurface detection, whether it be movement, whether it be noise, you name it. And obviously a lot of these issues are still in the news now, but these were high priorities, probably 10, 12 years ago, probably still are today. Obviously I'm not privy to that, but I would say at the end of the day, it is all about supporting the warfighter, whether as a defense agency or a combat support agency, and having those relationships and having the ability to adjust to meet the needs that they have and bring them to bring them solutions as quickly as possible.
Now, one of the questions I've sort of contemplated over time with these agencies, and so I'd be curious to know, I don't really have a firmly held position on it, is this idea of would defense agency capabilities be better dispersed in the actual services, or are they better sort of pulled out to support the services?
No, you know, my opinion is having them pulled out allows organizations to focus, you know, in on those specific missions. I think having a DITRA, having that central location, a place for all the combatant commands and all the services to come to for expertise and experience, it's probably a lot easier than every individual entity trying to maintain that capacity, capability on their own. So I do think there's a lot of value. I think it's more a much more simplistic, straightforward process to ensure that the warfighter has the skills they need and the capabilities they need when they need them.
Now, you've been in industry for a while after leaving government, and you've had the time to reflect. And so is there, as an industry guy now, is there anything you sort of look towards government and say, you know what, if you did this, you know, you'd work much more efficiently. You'd be more effective. Is there one, two, three lessons that you look back now?
It's a great question. I would tell you, you know, I have kind of a unique background. I feel I've been on all three legs of the stool: the legislative branch, the executive branch, and now industry. And I think there's a common problem across all three, and that is industry really doesn't understand how government works. Now, there are some, but as a whole, really doesn't understand not only how government works, but why it's doing the things it's doing when it's doing it. So that's number one. Number two, I also think there's a misunderstanding in government of industry and what the motivations are. You know, there are a lot of great Americans, fantastic patriots who get up every single day trying to figure out how to support the United States, the American people, the warfighter, what have you, and they're in industry. The government goals and mission are impossible without industry support, and obviously vice versa. And I think we as a government and as an industry really need to work harder to understand where each other is coming from. You know, whether we're talking about levels of risk, a corporate level of risk, most people in government, don't really think about the difference between a private company and a public company and how that impacts the level of risk a company might be willing to take on or even able to take on. So I think there's a lot of value and a lot of benefit of getting industry experience in government and getting government experience in industry. I don't know exactly how to do that. I think there are probably a number of pitfalls, but I think the more we learn about each other, the better off we're going to be in terms of our national security interests. It is not an easy balance to strike. It is not one that anyone does perfectly. But I think the more we understand, the more we learn each other, the more we understand where each other's red lines are, and more importantly, why they're there, I think we'll improve and increase the level of cooperation and as a result, improve the outcome.
Now, it's that time in the show where I like to bring out Bob the Genie. And so as I rub my magic lamp and Bob pops out, of course, he grants all guests 3 wishes, but they have to be related to the topics we've been discussing. So no world peace, no infinite wishes, only our discussed topics. So, Ken, as Bob grants you wish number 1, what is that wish?
Continued technological advancement. My number 1 wish is that the United States has been the technological leader for a number of years. I think there are many in the government community and the industry community who believe that's at risk or might have already been, we might have already been surpassed in some areas. But I think my number 1 wish is I want to take over, I want to regain technological superiority, not only over our near peer competitors, but over all of our competitors.
Yeah, that's a good one because, you know, as we look at warfare, our success has largely been dependent upon the fact that we have much better tech. So it's a good wish. Okay, so wish number 2 then.
You know, I'll go a little preface before I get to the answer. One of the biggest concerns I have today is maintaining the level of commitment to the warfighter, to U.S. national security. Obviously, some very difficult political situations, not only on the Hill, but elsewhere throughout American society now. But the one thing we were always able to come together on when I served under Senator Richard Lugar and in the United States Senate was support to the U.S. warfighter, support to U.S. national security. My second wish is that none of us ever can or have to question whether that remains. I know that sounds a little bit wordy, but I don't want to be accusatory. So I just want to make sure that we all continue to maintain that's the central element, that U.S. national security and the warfighter always have to have our complete attention. And it really must be a bipartisan or nonpartisan issue.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good one. I can agree with that. It's a good wish. Now, how about wish number 3?
Maybe this is more the father in me or as the not the industry executive or former defense agency director, but you know, I hope all of the investments that we've made to deter any type of nuclear war or nuclear exchange, the skill sets that are at DITRA to support that mission, you know, I hope to God and pray they never have to be used. But I also do realize and appreciate the need that they have to be credible. And that is the best way to ensure they never have to be used. So I would say continued credibility, but never having to prove it of the U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile.
Yeah, I've got a 13-year-old, and his plan is he's working towards a nuclear engineering degree.
Wow.
And
fantastic.
And he wants to be a nuclear propulsion officer in the Navy, and he wants to be on a submarine. And
right.
And he was telling me, we were talking the other day on the way to the gym, and he says, Dad, we're probably going to fight China when I'm in the Navy. And so I said, well, that could be, his name's Wyatt. And I said, that could be true, Wyatt. But let's hope not. Let's hope not. So much like you, I think about those things as well, because I've got a kid who, may very well be in the position I was in, 30 years ago, where, you're waiting to see whether war comes or doesn't. So it's certainly a good wish to hope that we can avoid it and that deterrence holds, and because it's all of our wishes.
Sure.
So as we wrap the show up and you think about, like, what's your sort of walking off the stage message for the NucleCast audience in terms of DITRA and support agencies? What would you have them remember 6 to 12 months from now about our discussion on NucleCast?
Well, I guess it'd be two and a half items here. One, you may not know a lot about them. You may not be 100% sure how they work, but let there be no mistake. You are in need of them. And I mean that when I talk about DITRA, I mean that when I talk about most of the defense agencies and combat support agencies. I used to like to say that, DITRA was the most important organization no one had ever heard of. And I hope it stays that way, because if the director of DITRA is on a Sunday morning talk show or is on the nightly news, something very bad has happened. Having the director of DITRA on that show means that there are very few people who can answer the questions. And that's probably not good news for us. I would also, and this kind of goes back to the, my second genie wish, I would just ask for everybody, when it comes to U.S. national security, when it comes to the warfighter, when it comes to our mission, bringing the country together is absolutely critical. We cannot afford to be divided in this critical area. So I would just say, be thankful for those, even though if you don't know exactly what they're doing, because they are keeping the country safe. And please help all of us keep our focus on U.S. national security and the warfighter.
All right. Ken Myers, thanks for joining us on NucleCast.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it. Appreciate it.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode. Well, we just talked to Ken Myers, Senior Vice President at FLUR and the former Director of the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. And we talked about DITRA and its mission and its history and what are defense agencies and combat support agencies and how do they contribute to the Department of Defense and warfighters. And it was a good discussion. But for you to know what he said, you gotta listen to the show.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Channington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krumpel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.